Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Tuesday, February 14th. Today we have Joseph Wang and Ira Harris. Joseph spent 5 years studying the plumbing of the financial system as a senior trader on the open desk market at the Federal Reserve. The desk sits at the center of the dollar system as its ultimate and infinite provider of dollars. It has access to virtually all regulatory and financial data, as well as open lines of communication with the major market participants. It's one of the few places in the world where one can definitely learn how the system works. And prior to the desk, Joseph was a credit analyst and in another life practiced law. Joseph is known as the Fed Guy at his website, fedguy.com. It's a dedicated website with great, insightful report commentaries. Ira's independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it is. This is a great pleasure yet again. So thank you, Richard, for making it possible. Thank you, Joseph, for allowing me to have a little bit of your time.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Joseph, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets. How do you see it today?
So what I'm seeing today is that the market becoming more aware of the fact that maybe inflation is not as easily defeated as they perceive them to be. So today is February 14th, and we just got the latest CPI report, and I think the market seems to perceive it as suggesting a higher than expected rate path, or rather, maybe it suggests that the Fed has been more correct in its expectations that rates will stay higher for longer. And that's slowly making its way into the financial markets. So I think that's likely the right call. Inflation is very likely to be persistent and maybe more beyond this year as well. So that has a number of implications, not just in the US, but globally as well. So I think the first implication obviously is that rates are going higher. That affects everything that is sensitive to that. So credit, maybe tech stocks and so forth. But what I find more interesting right now is the FX component. And that's because that this inflation problem is global, but the way that monetary policy works in each country is very different. In the US, for example, when the Fed hikes rates, it's not as impactful to households because many of the households have fixed rate rental mortgages that are about 30 years in tenor, can be refinanced, tax deductible, and I think most people have their mortgage rates around 3%, but it's very different in other countries, in Canada, for example, or Australia or the UK, and many other countries in Euroland. The impact of monetary policy flows much smoothly to households. So you can just hike a little bit and you can have your desired effect. So for me, just from a market, I guess, participant perspective, I think the dollar is probably going to strengthen significantly forward if inflation really is more persistent as I expect it to be, simply because the tools that the Fed has require them to raise it higher. And whereas the tools other central banks have can be effective with just smaller increases.
Interesting, great insight. Your thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, no, that is a very interesting. I'm glad you brought that up. Because my overall view on the dollar is, I have a different perspective. I think that the dollar, well, when the dollar was going higher last year, I thought the dollar was way too strong and was creating real risk in the global economy because so many people, the debt load in the global economy in dollars, of course, is so great. And as we were running up and interest rates were going up, so you were getting especially a lot of the emerging market world were getting double whacked and they were forced to raise their rates. So you were creating this very difficult situation of great financial stress in the global system. And I know from reading your work, you certainly would agree with that. So if the Fed does get a little more aggressive here, and I think the point you make is really well thought out, in my opinion, because as you say, it bleeds more into the housing markets. And I think Canada, as you talk about it, is a perfect case. Now, Mechlin has 2 weeks ago came out and said, well, that was after they raised, I think it was, I'm old, Joseph, so my mindset is a little.
I remember they surprised the market once and did 100 basis points, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty impressive. That was surprising. But I think, as you noted, he kind of declared victory in a sense in his last press conference. And I think that makes sense for him. I mean, think about all the people, every year, a lot of people in Canada have to refinance their mortgages. They usually have about, let's say, 5 years in tenure that they refinance every 5 years with, I think, 20-year repayment period or some amortization period. So a lot of people get hit by higher interest rate costs every year. And so just by raising a little bit and holding it there, a lot of people are going to have less disposable income, and that tampens down demand significantly for them. So for him, I think it makes perfect sense, but that's not going to happen. That won't have the same effect in the US.
I agree with you, but then he gets, that was, I think, last week, and then Friday he gets hit with that enormous employment report, 150,000 jobs and 136,000 were full-time. They were looking for 10,000 and the rate to go up to 5.2 they got, and it came down to 5. So he gets very, the only point I make is he gets very interesting here, because if he's willing to slow, and that's what he said, that they would probably be on pause for a little bit because he wanted that great phrase that seems to resonate, that monetary policy reacts with a great lag effect, and he was going to wait to see that through. So I thought that was going to actually put a little pressure on Powell to be a little more reticent to raise rates. But that's why I really like your point, because I have to rethink that. And now what Mechlin does makes really interesting because of that unemployment report was so robust. But I think the point is really well taken. And Richard's up in Canada, so I'm sure he has a view on that too.
Yeah, it's quite challenging environment here. That there's a lot of factors going on. They're now making it higher down payments, you know, for getting qualified under the CMHC program, and then there's also this unoccupied property type of tax that's just been levied. Because there was a thinking that there was a lot of speculation by international investors just buying property and leaving them, you know, unoccupied. So there's all kinds of things going on here. A lot of stresses in different directions, intervention by the government at different levels.
You know, one of the interesting things about the Canadian labor market is that They're basically importing 500,000 people a year through immigration. And Canada's a lot smaller than the US. So the Canada, I just looked it up, it's about 39 million people population. So about the size of California. And if you keep having such strong immigration numbers every year, you'd expect, you know, the labor market to probably soften, right? You're increasing the supply of labor significantly every year for such a small country. But even after that, the labor market continues to create lots of jobs. So that's pretty interesting to me. And if it can continue that, that's really good for growth, because you're increasing the number of people working in that country.
Mm-hmm. It's a really good point, but that makes him an interesting canary in the coal mine, so to speak, because, I mean, as you say, so when you really think about that 150,000, that was like creating, if you use lousy numbering, we could find it's like 1.5 million jobs in the
US. Yeah, that's amazing, really.
Yeah. It is amazing. And yet he said he's going to pause for a while. And I think your point is dead right on, because of the housing situation. And because of that, don't forget, they didn't get hit in 2007 and 2008. Because of their bank regs are a little bit different.
Their banks went on a buying spree. Yeah, the TD came down and bought these big American banks, and BMO Bank came down and bought Harris Bank. So they were the winners. Their banking sector came in and they had a foothold into the US. So they, but I actually was listening to someone podcast about this right now. Some people are concerned that as the property market deflates and mortgage premiums go higher, maybe the banks would suffer because they hold a lot of those mortgages. But apparently what I'm hearing is that the banks, of course, offloaded them to, non-bank financial institutions to hold. So the banking system so far will be okay if you have declines in property value. So that's one perspective that I've heard.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Yeah, interesting.
Interesting. And turning back on the U.S., was interested in your thoughts on the issue or the topic of quantitative tightening. What is happening from your perspective? How fast is it happening? And what the potential effects are on the economy and the financial markets?
I think the first thing since we've last talked, the first development about quantitative tightening that I've seen is that now the expectation is that it can go on for 2 or 3 years, regardless of what happens. So earlier, there was a couple concerns about quantitative tightening. So first is that the way that it's been proceeding, it has been draining liquidity out of the reverse repo, not from the reverse repo facility, which the Fed thinks of as just extra cash that no one wants, but it's been draining cash out of the banking system. The Fed has this constraint where they want quantitative tightening to reduce the liquidity in the banking system, but not so much that it goes below some minimum threshold. And if quantitative tightening is only draining liquidity out of the banking system rather than the RRP, and there are some, in the weeds plumbing reasons for that, then maybe quantitative tightening can't go on as long as was expected. So at the beginning, Chair Powell was suggesting 3 years, but if we hit our minimum reserve threshold, let's say in a year, then there is some thought that maybe we couldn't continue quantitative tightening. That's one point. The other point is that as we see in the markets futures were implying rate cuts sometime at the end of this year. And I think that's been pushed back a bit. And the Fed has this dogma where our balance sheet policy and our rate policy have to be consistent. And what that means is that you can only do quantitative tightening when you're hiking rates, and you can only do quantitative easing when you're cutting rates. So you don't slip on the gas and the brakes at the same time. So that's the same. And if you hold that view and you're pricing in rate cuts in the future, then obviously you also assume that quantitative tightening ends very soon. Now, those two points were put to rest recently by Governor Waller, who after the departure of Lil Brainard is probably going to be a much more influential person in the FOMC's thinking. So Governor Waller basically said that, when I look at banking sector liquidity when it comes to QT, I also take into account the RRP. So that takes away one concern. And the other concern is that he explicitly stated that he's happy cutting rates and maintaining QT at the same time. And that's a very big change in the Fed's thinking. And if that is the case, then quantitative tightening can continue for as long as the Fed wants. So let's say, I think 3 years probably at this current pace, simply because we don't have a lot of mortgage prepayments. So that has a big impact in the markets, in my view, because the way that policy is transmitted through the Fed is uneven. So right now, the Fed is hiking rates. Let's say we're about 5% on the overnight rate. But if you think about the actual interest rates that most people in the market face, if I log into my checking account, I'm still getting 0% on my checking account. And that's the same for literally trillions and trillions of dollars. And so for them, there have been no rate hikes. And for them, if I'm getting 0% on my checking account, inflation is 5%, I'm going to want to do something to get ahead of inflation. Maybe I buy treasury bills, or maybe I think that because stocks always go to the moon, I buy more stocks. So I think that's making the transmission of policy more difficult simply because rate hikes haven't touched a lot of people. An extended quantitative tightening helps that because at a high level, when you're doing quantitative tightening and you're draining money out of the banking sector instead of the RRP, someone somewhere is losing a deposit and gaining a treasury security. So it's like a ginormous asset swap. Bank deposits yield zero, treasuries yield around four, maybe even five, depending on what tenor you're buying. So you're basically hiking rates at a $60 billion a month pace by exchanging $60 billion in zero yielding bank deposits for $60 billion in treasury securities with a much higher yield. So that's happening in the background steadily. About $500 billion so far. So as the transmission of policy is more broadened to more people, I think that will have an impact on risk appetite.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Your thoughts, Aaron?
Well, this opens up all kinds of things. And I will tell you this anecdotally. Friday, I moved 90% of my funds in my Chase checking account because I had received recent large deposits. And I moved 90% into a Chase money market, which now went from paying me zero to I'm almost at 4%. And there is no penalty to it. So they're waking up. They have to, because there must be bleeding. Because I have a standing joke at Chase when I walk up to the tellers and I give them a check to deposit, I put up my hands because I know that they're robbing me. And you know, we always get that discussion. I always get that. But now I want to make sure that I heard this right. So you said that Waller would embark upon quantitative easing. Would embark upon cutting interest rates while maintaining quantitative tightening at the same time. I heard that right.
Exactly right. In fact, I actually bookmarked that exact second on an interview. I can just send it to the chat here. He said he was asked point blank if he would be doing quantitative tightening even when he cuts rates. And he's like, yes, I would be open to that. Let me actually send that to the chat. It's quite interesting.
So, but that's diametrically opposed to what Powell reiterated that again in that what I thought was a wonderful interview with David Rubenstein. I thought that's as good as you get, you know, as far as being pretty straightforward. And you had outside of Richard Benugli, Rubenstein is a really good interlocutor who asked the questions that, and I'm sure you feel that same way, Joseph, that market participants really want to hear, rather than the media who ask questions that their editors want to hear, and they get their walking paper, they get their battle plans based on what they think their readers are going to understand. That was really good. And I was amazed. See, I thought it was pretty dovish. I'm going to come back to Waller, but I thought it was pretty dovish because Rubenstein gave him four or five opportunities to walk back the disinflation comments, which we haven't even discussed yet. But, you know, and people were counting again. Now we're back to Kremlinology, how many times he used the word disinflation. So we're measuring it. And it was evident because he didn't just say it once. Once could be a slip of the tongue, 7, 8, 9, whatever the actual number was. He's sending a message. And yet Rubenstein, after that big unemployment report, gave him a chance to walk it back, and Powell did not walk it back. He stayed the course, which kind of surprised me. And of course, as you maintain, it was Waller who took the place of Nick Timiraos and actually told us about 10 days before the Fed meeting, 25 basis points seemed to be baked in the cake. And I think that's right. So your point about Waller and Brainard, what I find it interesting. So if we go down that road, okay, because I'm looking at it from a trading perspective. If we go down Waller's road, cuts with quantitative tightening, does the yield curve, in your opinion, steepen out and go positive dramatically?
So I don't know about dramatically, but I think the mechanically, that's kind of the straightforward play, right? But potentially, maybe next year you cut rates a bit, and as you continue to increase the supply of treasuries, you're to the markets, you are, you know, pushing the longer and higher. And I agree with you that I thought it was a great interview. What I appreciated the most was the first question right off the bat was basically, we got a hot employment report. Does that change your thinking, right? Now that's what everyone really cares about, right? not how Paul rides his bike to work and all that, but yeah. We want to know about that. And that was very helpful. And you're exactly right. Paul is a very smart guy, and he knows how to manage the message. So he's sending a very clear message, disinflation, that everything's working. And so, you know, we were really behind last year. Now we're getting to where we want to go, and then we're just kind of fine-tuning the conditions, and we're going to look at data. Now, the problem I have with that is that, you know, future data is heavily dependent upon what the Fed does and doesn't do, right? The Fed is not some kind of independent actor. So what's been happening the past few months is that a lot of the tightening that was put into the market is being taken out. And so Powell had a chance to push back against that. And as you mentioned, he said disinflation, 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 and he didn't really take it back. There are some anecdotal reports that you have reacceleration in parts of the market that are more interest rate sensitive, like housing. On Twitter, the Redfin CEO was suggesting that the housing market reaccelerated in January. So, and I listened to people on YouTube who are real estate agents, and they're all saying the same thing across the country. So, you know, if you don't push, and part of the reason is that mortgage rates were, you know, 7% late last year. Now they're 6%, dipping below 6. If you're buying a new home, they'll probably buy down your mortgage to close to 5. So that's a world where you can see activity reaccelerate. So if you don't maintain a tight conditions, if you don't push back against the market, it's possible that you know, you are repeating the stop and go strategy back in the 70s. You know, market rates are not just the overnight rates, right? It's the perception of the path of policy. So you can easily have a stop and go by just not pushing back against the tightening, the loosening that the market is pricing in.
Well, you know, I think Wall Street is probably more responsible for this binary view that it's either raising or easing. But if they pause for another year as they wait, when I say pause, maybe they get an all of a sudden terminal rate. I don't know where this came from. All of a sudden we talk about terminal rates. The terminal rate is what I find on my Bloomberg. That's what I think. But so let's say they get to 5. It's still a slowing of the rapid movement we had in 2022, but a pause is a pause. And yeah, you know, higher for longer. Their mantra was at zero, lower for longer, right? That was the forward guidance, lower for longer. So, and they didn't go below zero. I mean, back then people were predicting when would they go negative. Yes, we saw T-bill rates dip negative, but the Fed's official policy never went negative. I think they were very nervous about that, especially in its role as the world's reserve currency. Where would we go with that? So, again, I come back to the yield curves, and I say to you, who I would honestly, Joseph, without blowing smoke at you, you're probably in the top 5 plumbers that I pay attention to, and I'll name them. You and Mark Cabana, and I learned from James Aitken out of.
Yeah, those are great guys.
He is phenomenal. James taught me so much. In fact, I surrendered my whip inflation now button to him as a gift for teaching me.
Nice.
So we've had, you know, so you're definitely in there. And with Pozar, because when Pozar was not the global macro guy and was really focusing on
plumbing. Absolutely. Everything I know, I learned from reading Global Money Notes religiously, really. That was like the highlight of my, whenever I got it, I read it immediately. I multiple times. So I really am indebted to Zoltan for a lot of my knowledge.
Yeah. So I put you right in there. But then when I see the way this plays out, I just keep coming back to that 210 curve, and I go, and it's, I don't care whether, you know, again, recession, to me, that language, we'll be able to see it and the way the markets react. And this one is a little different because we've never been in zero land for so long. So it's so hard to price. How do you price a 10-year treasury today in any kind of real contextual sense? You know, because I always keep coming back and go, who's buying this stuff? Why would you buy a 10-year? Yeah. I can buy a 1 year, a 180-day or 3 month and have some flexibility. To me, anybody buying a 10-year is basing it on mean reversion after last year's beating. Although then I run into a stone wall with David Rosenberg and Lacey Hunt, two other really great analysts. So, yeah, how do you see that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And like you mentioned, the inverted yield curve, great track record. Look at it for the past 100 years, right? It's doing a great job predicting recessions. I look at it, in my view, there's a big structural change in the post-GFC world. And the structural change is in two ways. One is that you have a lot more sovereign involvement in the global bond markets. So not just quantitative easing in here at the Fed and the ECB, but even so far as explicit yield curve control in the Bank of Japan. And as we know, global bond markets are strongly connected. So you can't have like a Japanese 10-year at 10 basis points and like a, you know, other bond yields stray too far from that. That's kind of it influences how far everything else can go. And that's one thing. The other thing is that you have a fundamental regulatory sea change, where many, many highly regulated entities have to buy government bonds. And the commercial banks, for example, are an obvious candidate to buy high quality liquid assets. And immediately after COVID, there were huge buyers, a few hundred billion dollars. So when I'm trying to figure out what's pricing the market when I look at the 10-year, I have to keep in mind, well, some people value this according to the regs because they have to do this. Insurance companies as well. And, you know, if you are a big pension fund, you got to show that the regulators that I have long duration safe assets, right? So that's all putting a bid in. And of course, I have to take into account, well, what's the sense of policy? Well, you got these huge central banks having a lot of, duration on their balance sheets and sometimes even controlling the interest rates, that has to have an impact as well. So it's not purely driven by expectations of growth or inflation more. And the last point that I actually think is important, but it's a bit wonky, but since you guys are all deep into this, is that financing is not infinite anymore. So in the pre-GFC world, if you were a big investment fund and you wanted to put on a view, you could easily get basically unlimited repo financing. So if you are a sophisticated investor, you have a lot of influence on what the market prices are. Today, financing is limited. You can't just go, lever up infinitely because of balance sheet constraints. And so maybe that class of investor has less influence in shaping prices.
If I may, Richard, so if we go down that road, you talk about the huge amount of high quality liquid assets that the banks had to buy. And I guess this is what bothers some bank analysts who look at it and go, well, they're sitting on this huge stockpile. It's not a stockpile, it's a huge pool of assets that they bought during that time that they're now, if it's the philosophers, if they had to sell or liquidate them, they would incur huge losses. And as long as they're holding them, I go back to Basel Accord. So zero sovereign debt is a zero risk weighted asset, right? I think
exactly. It's zero. It's zero weighted.
So it carries a lot of uncertainty. We're not seeing it yet because they don't have to liquidate. But if there was to be a selling of debt, there bank balance sheets would change dramatically. Now, will you with your vast amount of Fed experience, does that play into the Fed? Because I have, it's a two part issue. Because does that play into the Fed? And then I'll get to the second part with that.
My sense is that, just looking at, other comprehensive income, which is how this would show up at a bank's balance sheet, the way that it affects capital, my impression is that it depends on the size of the bank. So I think smaller banks are not are less affected or something like that. But I'm not exactly sure. But I would actually say this about that. So one is that a lot of banks do hedge their interest rate exposure. But the second point, and I think is often missed, is that, you know, banks have assets and liabilities. If you have interest rates rising, yes, that hurts your fixed income assets. But what about your deposit liabilities? You can model a deposit like a, you know, zero coupon perpetual, right? So you have a liability that pays no interest rates and that goes on perpetually. When interest rates rise, that liability is worth a lot less. So your net worth is not necessarily affected. Oh. You lose on your assets, but your liabilities are worth less as well. So we have to take into account how higher interest rates affect their liabilities as well.
Well, that is a great answer. Now, let me see if I can remember this. Oh, so as the Fed raises interest rates to fight the inflation battle, of course, the enormous amount of debt that was placed onto the book of the United States, the cost of that, and so much of it is coming due because they didn't heed Larry Summers. And I know sometimes it's difficult to heed Larry Summers by not extending out to, you know, as much as they could to 30 years. So you have a lot of, and the cost, I know tomorrow the CBO comes out with their new estimate on the cost of interest payments, right? It's now we got to look at it. So now Powell says, no, that's a fiscal issue. And he is brilliant at staying awake, but he's a trained lawyer. And he knows how to react to the question, when did you stop beating your wife? So he stays away from the fiscal issue. But this issue of the cost of the debt is really going to become a hot political item.
No, I agree completely. About Powell staying away from the fiscal action, I actually think that's a bit concerning, because the truth is that, you know, inflation is not all about what the Fed does, not all about interest rates. If you have a tremendous amount of fiscal spending, that's going to have a big impact on inflation. And by stepping out of that debate, he makes his own job harder. Now, for reference, the European Central Bank, you can see people like Isabel Schnabel giving speeches, and actually Lagarde as well, saying that, hey, European governments, you are subsidizing your energy costs, right? And so that doesn't help our fight on inflation, because you keep printing money to pay for energy. So they have the courage to say that, to push back against the fiscal authorities saying that you're doing inflationary stuff. But the Fed kind of, I think, needs to kind of step in and say something. Otherwise, it's not going to get better. And obviously, you know, during the pandemic, they actually stepped in and said, you should do more fiscal spending. So you got to be fair now.
Yeah.
Back then, maybe we needed fiscal spending. Now we don't. You should say something. But about how this affects monetary policy, you know, it kind of goes back to the original MMT argument, where when you hike interest rates, it's actually inflationary. Why? Because you increase the interest income to the private sector, and so they have more money. Now, that's not true today. But I can easily imagine a world in the future where that is true, where the picture that you're painting, all this interest, that's a problem, because let's say GDP to debt to GDP is 200% one day and interest rates are at 7%. Then every time you hike rates to try to slow the economy down, because the debt base is so high, the interest income that the households receive is huge, they get more money, and that it's actually pro-cyclical, it's actually inflationary. And at that point, monetary policy, it's going to be really tricky. So there's actually a classic paper by Sargent and Wallace about, it's called some unpleasant monetary arithmetic. And they speculated on this. It's actually an influential paper in monetary economics. And their conclusion is that in that circumstance, they take the MMT view that you actually lower rates to zero to fight inflation. Because if you were to hike rates, the interest income that the private sector receives is too high. So you hike it to zero. And the assumption in all this is that the interest is paid by basically borrowing more or printing more money rather than running a budget surplus or something like that.
Yeah, I think that was Warren Mosler's original viewpoint on how to get to MMT. And, you know, but when I listen to that, then I go, well, if we apply that, and I'm not saying it because I don't know enough to say whether it's right or wrong, but then it would certainly you may as well eradicate the concept of real positive yields, because real positive yields is effectively saying, I'm going to pay you more than the cost of inflation. So you're going to have more money for all sorts of things. Now, I will tell you, as a senior citizen, the last 12, 13 years have not been very good for me, unless I had an overweighted investment posture in the equity markets. But if I had structured my entire retirement as I did, based on basically a 4 or 5% nominal yield, I had to, I mean, one of the, to invoke Louis Gavet, they don't pay me to forecast. My wife pays me to be flexible in my investment portfolio. So we got flexible. But when we, if you eradicate real yields, number one, I'll never buy a bond again. I'll keep everything short and be flexible, because of real yields, because I know that over the last 45 or 50 years, the effective real yield on a 10-year note was almost 2%. I'm pretty sure that's right. I haven't looked it up in quite a while, but that was just pretty standard. We've been nowhere near that in the last 15 years. So it would certainly change my entire investment. Now, I don't know how many years I have left. I am getting to the end of the great roundup, but I bonds would be the last thing that I would buy if we never get to real positive yields again. So,
but wouldn't cash be even more negative though, even if bond yields were negative? Or yes. Is the optionality more valuable for you?
Yeah, that's, I'm with Warren. It's one of the few places I line up, unfortunately, with Warren Buffett. That optionality has great value to me. So I'm willing to take a little bit. Either way, I'm having my real, my money is being eroded, but at least I get eroded with an optionality and gives me some flexibility. So, but it's a really good point. I hear you loud and clear, and it makes me think a lot of things, but that's why, you know, we got into it about the steepening curve, how this curve will stay inverted. It gets really interesting, because I just can't see it. Cause my question always, when I start the day, is who's buying it? I mean, I can get 4.6 or 4.7 on short dated, and at the long end, I'm getting 3.5, 3.6, maybe 3.7, and I have capital risk and a whole lot of other things. But yeah, that's just me.
Issuance is tremendous too. And I mean,
yeah.
One other thing that I thought was interesting is that, so there's a couple guys, Brad Settler and someone else who does great work on balance of payments in for Japan. And one of the things they've noticed is that the Japanese are not big buyers of U.S. bonds anymore. And they weren't for the past few decades. And I think part of the reason is because after FX hedging costs. So when you're FX hedging, of course, you're basically borrowing short and lending long. And because the curve is inverted, all these FX hedgers step out. And so you have less demand from people who are traditionally very big buyers. And yet the curve is still like this. So I'm inclined to think that it will steepen. So we'll see.
Yeah. And I'm glad I'm sorry, Richard.
Go ahead. Yeah.
The Japan issue is really important, because Japan, I think, has been a free rider, because with their zero interest rate, you had the government pension investment fund, you had Norichukin, you had so much, and of course, I haven't even gotten into the insurers who were pouring money into foreign markets, of course, and resulting in a weakening yen. So they had it, they were giving away some, but they were searching for nominal yields. That's reversing. But I thought when we got up to 150, 151 in dollar yen, that the world should have looked at Japan and go, are you out of your minds? Because we're back to levels, and you see it now, because you want to talk about reshoring. Japan is bringing businesses home, and they're building up that chip industry as some of it leaves China, and certainly somewhat Taiwan. So, and even at 130, 133, I think the yen is on a relative basis very cheap, and they were able to get away with it because, as you talk about, they went searching for yield. But if yield starts to return to Japan, who knows where that yen? But Japanese corporations are flush with cash, even in this poor environment in some ways.
Yeah, and so looking out for the rest of this year, Joseph, like how do you see the U.S. dollar playing out, the strength of the dollar, and also U.S. inflation rates, you know, given your views on the yield curves, interest rates, bond yields, and also international factors, right? Maybe like supply, demand on commodities.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? Yeah.
I think a very, very serious risk that is not being properly priced in the markets is the prospect of just re-escalation of war. Now, we have Seymour Hersh has that article on his Substack, and Seymour Hersh obviously is a very respected journalist, suggesting that you know, the US blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. And that actually makes a ton of sense, right? The US does not like Germany and Russia being friends, so they're basically stepping in and doing the hard choices. So that's an act of war, obviously. And so that also suggests that the US, and it should be obvious by now, the US and NATO sending tremendous amounts of weapons and tanks to the Ukraine to fight Russia. There's a huge proxy war going on. And they seem committed to that. And that has the prospect of accelerating, I think, significantly. And of course, this past weekend, we have the US going around shooting down Chinese balloons. Now, to be clear, of course, China should not have spy balloons in the US, but everyone spies on each other, right? I think the interesting question is, why are we shooting balloons now today? I think that there, I mean, and if you think back not too long ago, you had Nancy Pelosi just fly over to Taiwan, hug the president of Taiwan and say like, yeah, we're totally one China. By the way, Taiwan is our good friend. So I think that I think there are at least factions in the US government who kind of want to have war. And that's not surprising. I think, I mean, we have a huge war industry and we've always had war for the past 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya and so forth. And I think they still want war. And I think they can get that. So that is a serious geopolitical risk that's not in the markets. It has, I think, tremendous implications for currencies and for inflation as well, since we are a globally integrated world. And if we have some kind of disruption geopolitically, that will be tremendously inflationary by shrinking the supply of certain goods and services. And I think that's a good hedge. So I like long dollar, as I mentioned, is being long dollar, because if that happens, money's going to pour back into the US. But absent something like that, the way that I see the markets and inflation, I think that inflation will continue to be persistently strong, persistently high. And that's for a few fundamental reasons. One is that obviously the labor market is strong. So people have jobs, have good wage increases, they can afford higher prices. And if you can afford higher prices, then prices continue to go higher. Well, another aspect that I've been writing about that's not gotten a lot of attention is that we have a tremendous credit boom in the banking sector. At a high level, when a bank makes a loan, they're creating money out of thin air. So usually the banking sector over the past few years creates about $400 billion in loans and leases. Last year, they created $1.2 trillion. And that's, I think, a function of low rates, but also strong household balance sheets. People have jobs, people's net worths are high, so they have a lot of borrowing capacity. That's a lot of money that's hasn't really filtered into the economy yet. And so far, credit lending still seems to be pretty strong. I read that banks have tightened up their standards, but in terms of raw credit growth, it's still pretty strong. So, you know, there's money coming in, people have wages, asset prices remain elevated. So I think inflation will demand continues to be strong. So that means that people can afford higher prices. Inflation stays high, Fed stays higher for longer, rates stay higher for longer, curve steepens.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's interesting perspective. And your thoughts, Ira? Yeah.
Well, Joseph just elevated himself further in my mind, not to raise anything, because I don't hear people his age discuss Seymour Hersh. Now, you know, I'm old enough that Seymour Hersh played an important part in my education when people actually would read magazine. You know, Seymour Hersh was a highly regarded investigative journalist, and then he went off and did some things that even I would, but certainly he was always worth a read. And this one has been, it's amazing that the mainstream media has totally stayed away from this article. Almost like you think that there's a conspiracy
effort. Say it.
Yeah, concerted effort to avoid right. it. But it's, you know, and I think Joseph is right on target, because when I read it and then I read it again, it laid the case for a direct confrontation between the Russians and it puts Scholz, who's in a dangerous situation right now, and he just lost an election. The SPD, they got killed in the Berlin election on Sunday. So there's all these things. So I think he's absolutely right to bring that up. And I'm not sure whether, I still don't get to the strong dollar out of it. I'm leaning to Posar. And it's interesting. I'm waiting for Zoltan to write about this. I know he's got to show up with this, because
I love Zoltan.
And I mean that. And it's important to discuss it, because it has, as you rightly point out, real world great implications. And mm-hmm. with all the things we're shooting down, and the other phrase I wake up now and say is the famous line, Richard, you're old enough. I don't know if Joseph is, from the day the earth stood still, Katu Barada Nictum, which was, she had to say to Gort, the robot, in order to save the world, those three words to get him, you know, this is how crazy the world and we, and I, you know, I just look at one more pile of tinder that could be ready to ignite. And I know that Joseph is sitting on the same thoughts, because we're going to go all over the place here. Any of these piles of tinder, you know, as Mao would say, it takes one spark to start a prairie fire. We've got a lot of potential prairie fires out there in the year of 2023. And I think Joseph has really covered them well. How they play out, that's going to be the markets will have to come to terms with it.
I agree completely. I remember in 2020 when I was looking at what was happening in China, there's a huge disease and so forth. And that seemed like a big deal to me, and the market's just kind of trended higher and didn't ignore it completely until one day it didn't. And sometimes I think the market is slow to realize this. And like you mentioned, it's not mentioned a lot in the press. So, you know, if we do have a real conflict, I would expect that the government to have big influence on what the press prints as well.
Interesting. And your ideas, any ideas that you have in terms of trading ideas that are you're looking at now or considering in the near future?
I like energy. That's where I put a lot of my money. So energy and long dollar. So long dollar for the reasons I mentioned before, but energy, because I like that the dividends are high paying. So I own a lot of royalty companies. Producers are good too. And so it seems that, again, in the back of my mind, I'm concerned about this geopolitical conflict. And so there's some real upside potential if you hold, let's say, Canadian producers or U.S. producers. They would really benefit from higher material prices. Mm-hmm. So I also like commodities like steel and aluminum. So like they say, don't fight the Fed, don't fight the government. The government really wants to do this big green project, and that takes a lot of industrial commodities. And of course, as Hiram mentioned, there is some reshoring going on in the U.S. as well. The Inflation Reduction Act, it's making a lot of Europeans very angry, because it gives a huge leg up to things that are largely produced in the U.S. So you have European companies moving their production to the U.S. for the cheap energy, and because they like because the Inflation Reduction Act encourages them to do so. I think that we're in a right now, and you know, mid-February, there's probably going to be a pullback, but I would, after maybe like a correction, I would buy more steel and aluminum. Mm-hmm. Aluminum in particular, since it's energy intensive, U.S. has energy advantage, and very, very important to the green transition. If you look at these power lines, you know, they're aluminum. So if you want to have an electrified world, you have to have the infrastructure to bring that electricity. So you need lots of stuff like that. Like, mm-hmm. yeah.
Very good. Yeah, interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, you know, I've voiced some. So I'm on this whole ESG. Yes, I wish it was more market directed than it was other issues. But I agree with Joseph. And one of my favorite plays is ABB, which is the huge European ABB. It's the Swiss.
ABB? Okay.
Yeah. It's a Swiss, Swedish huge engineering concern who has a huge input into the European Green Initiative. So I wondered with the pushback over the Inflation Recovery Act, how, and the stock's actually been performing pretty well. It's a big company, it's 110,000 employees, but they are huge. If there's going to be a build out of electric charging places, they will be on it. And I think when the violence stops in Ukraine, they will be a recipient. You know, when it comes to rebuilding things, it takes gigantic engineering firms like that. And they do have a huge green footprint, and they've pushed themselves that way because they've done a lot of stuff in the energy space. So I agree with you. And I think there's others, you know, can't help. I love the mining company. I love Glencore. It's at times it's a hard pill to swallow, but I think that they've put a lot of that more negative stuff behind them, and they're trying to put a better face. And I know they'd like to sell off their coal, but unfortunately coal has become an important entity, and it's a good time to sell things when prices are high, because you might actually find somebody else who wants to supplant it. But one of the things that I do like are some of the more undervalued assets as I view them, especially as Europe starts to raise rates, because I don't see Europe going down. We haven't talked much about Europe, but I hope we do that next time. With the quantitative tightening, she can't do that. Lagarde has a different situation.
Yeah.
Because if they go quantitative tightening, the EU fragment, bond market fragments. So they had talked about, and I actually read the paper, I don't know whether you had seen it, where the EU talked about going to a broker-dealer bond system once this ends, but you had to be domiciled in Europe because they didn't want Goldman, Morgan doing it from a US address. So I've been looking at Commerzbank, which has been a bank that has broken more hearts, you know.
Yeah, it's
as very much as a widow maker as the JGB market is. But if I was looking at a bank, and now they're starting to actually make money, they haven't paid a dividend in ages. But if I was looking for a European footprint with a cheap bank, and they are cheap, by any metric that you measure banking, they are cheap. And I wanted to be domiciled, and especially domiciled in Germany, Commerz, and I would swipe it out from under Deutsche Bank, because they've talked about that merger probably since you've been in college. So that one hasn't taken place. So I'm looking at things like that. I'm being very specific to things. And I like listening to Joseph's points. I think those are very, very well taken. Because you know what? My problem, and where I will disagree with Rosenberg and Lacey Hunt, who I respect phenomenally, is I just don't think the government would, any of these governments would tolerate a deflationary period, and they would do everything that they could, you know, and, you know, the deficit, as we know, be damned, let's get the economy going. So that's why I think Joseph's points are really well taken.
I think you raise a really good point, Yura. I mean, inflation is ultimately a political economy problem, right? If the government wants inflation, or they could just print and spend a lot of money if they want deflation, raise rates, raise taxes, and so forth. So it's about the values of a society, whether or not you can tolerate unemployment, how much of a premium you place on people having jobs. And it seems today we're very risk averse. We want people to have jobs. And inflation is something that I think a lot of people are more willing to accept.
Well, yeah, and I, you know, can I, Richard, I have one more point. Ahead, yeah. So, yeah. Joseph, you have such a good view to the Fed. So, with Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook and Susan Collins, and well, Brainerd, is she leaving? Was there a real announcement yet? Because I don't know.
Yes, yesterday, this morning.
Oh, it was. So, the announcement came out. So yeah. She will be leaving. So she will certainly be. So there's a lot of labor economists. And when I say labor economists, I mean, these are people who made their academic bones with labor economics, just like Janet Yellen. So there's a huge influence to tilt towards employment over everything else. Do you sense that?
I agree completely. I mean, well, so the Biden administration, from my perception, seems to be pretty left-leaning. And so I think if you're left-leaning, you tend to favor the employment mandate over the inflation mandate. And so obviously they would pick people who think that way to be their Fed people. And for the past year, you know, inflation's 7-8%, rates are at zero, really easy for even the most dovish of doves to hike rates to 4.5%. Today, that path is less clear. And so that the bias for me is that they would err on the side of caution. And so so basically more dovish than otherwise would be.
Yeah, and they lost Sarah Bloom Raskin. So it'll be interesting to see who they'll come back with. I think that will be a, and it's interesting too that there's no dissension within the Fed.
So one of the things I liked about the interview that Ruben's interview was that we learned that the Fed chair is basically lobbying 24/7. He talked to everyone before the meeting, right? That's him lobbying, trying to get everyone on the same page so there's no dissent.
And as a trader, I want to see the dissents. It's one of the great things about the Bank of England. Yeah. 6-3, 7-2. That tells me more. Now I know the ECB, and I'll tell you, and I know you want to end, Richard, but
no.
Go to the ECB, they don't publish a vote. But after the December meeting, Klaus Knot, who's one of the great hawks, especially being the head of the Dutch bank, he came out in an interview in the FT and said, I can tell you, December 27th in the interview, and he said more than a third wanted a 75 basis point hike, even though they were, and that's what he said. So I thought that was very telling. But I love dissent because dissent tells me more. It's the best forward guidance I could see as far as, you know, but they don't do it.
Yeah. Well, we might see some yet. So far, it's been easy. Maybe it'll be harder later on.
Well, when you replace Kashkari, I can feel comfortable we'll see a dissent.
Right. Yeah. Well, it's been a fantastic, insightful discussion. Great points. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Joseph?
Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me. And I really respect your deep expertise and long history in the market. So I always learn something when I come to these conversations. And I really appreciate reading your blog. Honestly, I see that blog post and I click immediately. So thanks for all your work. And if you guys are interested in learning more about my work, you can check out fedguy.com or follow me on Twitter, fedguy12.
I do, and it's greatly appreciated. And those are really high words, and I really appreciate that. But it's right back at you. You're one of the really worth a read always. And my readers know that. And anywhere that I go into different chat rooms and discuss things. So I told them, I said forward questions. I told them, send them to Richard because you get an opportunity. Or maybe one day we'll do an interactive, which will be really fun. Because there's a lot of bright people out
Trading
there
room.
Who want to know. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Richard.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah.
Bye, Richard.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.